like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal, come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest today is Andrea Gibbon, founder and president of Protecting Paws for Life, a nonprofit organization based in Largo, Florida, dedicated to helping domestic violence shelters become and remain pet-friendly. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and it's important to note that only a small percentage of domestic violence shelters accept pets. It's said to be just 17% nationwide. The implications of that small number are enormous. That is, more than 65% of women report staying with their abuser rather than leave their pets behind or surrender them to an animal shelter. Protecting Paws for Life is working to mitigate this long-standing limitation by offering guidance and resources to modify domestic violence shelters so they can accommodate pets and welcome survivors who previously wouldn't have sought refuge there. Additionally, Protecting Paws for Life has organized a supply drive running throughout October, benefiting local domestic violence shelters, seeking donations of a variety of items, including food, bedding, crates, dog and cat toys, and litter. We'll discuss Protecting Paws for Life, their efforts to vastly improve the scenario of domestic violence survivors who would seek safe harbor at a shelter, but feel conflicted when so many of those shelters currently don't accept pets, and related issues when I speak with Andrea Gibbon in just a moment here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Meanwhile, coming up later on today's show, I'll speak with Jennifer Langston, founder of Golden Ears Sanctuary and Rescue, a specialized refuge for senior hospice and disabled dogs, located in Wesley Chapel. As you might imagine, caring for these dogs requires more than a little money, and Golden Ears has an important fundraiser, Barks, Bags, and Brews, coming up November 8th. We'll hear more details both about Golden Ears and the benefit when Jennifer Langston joins us later in today's show. Right now, though, let's discuss the complicated world of domestic violence shelters, which again predominantly do not accept pets, and how that creates a pivotal obstacle for survivors who often refuse to leave a dangerous home if they can't bring their animals. We'll do this, of course, by talking with Andrea Gibbon, who started an organization, Protecting Paws for Life, striving to assist shelters by mitigating that scenario. So, with the reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Andrea Gibbon to Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Andrea.
Good morning. Thank you for having me today.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. And again, it's great to have a guest in studio. A lot of my guests are other parts of the country, so they're on phone or Zoom. So it's nice to be face-to-face and have actual eye contact with the guests. So that's fantastic.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
So, of course, in a moment or two, we'll delve into Protecting Paws for Life, its mission, and as I outlined in the introduction, the current challenges facing many survivors who would like to move to a domestic violence shelter but won't if they can't bring their pets. But first, let's kind of develop some context on you as the Protecting Paws founder and explore some of your background and history. So I understand you've been involved with animal rescue for about 25 years.
Yeah, I think it's almost 27 now.
Wow.
I'm counting, yeah.
So tell me about that. When did you get started and what prompted your first rescue efforts?
Yeah, so honestly, I walked into a PetSmart one day where they were having an adoption event, and I just wanted to get involved, not knowing that it would essentially become the rest of my life. Yeah, so I've done a little bit of everything from helping at adoption events to transport to fostering, up to running my own rescue for a short time, working inside shelters. And then I decided to finally get my certifications to become a dog trainer as well, because the rescue dogs definitely pulled on my heartstrings and I wanted to help even more. So I'm also a certified advanced canine trainer and behavior specialist.
Wow. Well, that's covered a lot of ground. We might go back and explore some of those a little more.
Sure.
A little more detail. So I take it some of this represents rescue and certain things you're doing in different parts of the country, like you haven't always been in Florida, if I'm not
correct. Thinking. Yeah, I was actually born and raised in New Jersey and started my rescue efforts. I partnered with some organizations in New Jersey and then found my way to Texas, where I continued to be involved more in fostering. And that's where I ran my own rescue, very small rescue for a very, very short amount of time there, but learned a lot in a very short amount of time. And then moved back to New Jersey, where we continued fostering efforts, and I got really involved in transportation at the time, just due to my time constraints. And then from New Jersey, wound up back in Florida, or wound up in Florida, and partnered with a rescue here for about 4 years. And when I decided to part ways from them, decided to found Protecting Paws. And that's where we are today.
So I'm curious, of course, why when you had formed your own rescue while you were in Texas, why that was so short-lived.
It's just, you know, resources, really, connections, and being able to just maintain that. I had some personal things, changes in my life going on in Texas as well. So helped several dogs and really just kind of did more behind the scenes work after that. So just kind of adopted a few dogs out under that rescue name and then kind of moved on to the next thing.
And if you had, say, more resources / financing, might it be assumed you would have continued longer,
probably
with that rescue. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
That's definitely often what the snag is. Like, I have good intentions, but I don't have the dough, basically, to cover that vet bill
exactly.
or that food bill or whatever. And pretty soon people say, okay, I know why I got into this, but I can't keep going.
Yeah.
And that sounds like maybe your scenario.
Yeah, and there's only so much you can do out of your own home. And that's kind of where we were running the rescue out of, with mine and my husband at the time's home. And it got to be a lot. So decided to just partner up with other established rescues and help them out.
Gotcha. So what's best about working in rescue? And you obviously had a lot of experiences, large and small, and a lot of experiences in different states. So what's the very best thing about working in rescue?
The very best thing working rescue is definitely when you see the positive outcomes, when you're able to take an animal from a situation that may not have been the best, work with them, rehabilitate them, and get them into a happy forever home, and knowing that that outcome is positive for them, basically changing their lives. That's where the self-rewarding part comes
from. That's great. And I'd be curious, given the sort of long arc of rescue that you've been into, and again, different geographical settings, what rescue policies or maybe philosophies have changed the most significantly over these 27 years that you've been doing rescue?
Wow, yeah. I mean, I think it's a lot. I think it's the understanding of where behavior comes from and where it's stemming from and being able to work through that rather than just automatically putting an animal on a euthanasia list. You know, there is a huge no-kill movement right now trying to get as many shelters to be no-kill, meaning no euthanasia for behavioral reasons.
Yeah.
So I think that's probably one of the biggest changes is seeing that pivot from automatically putting a behavior case on the euthanasia list to giving them a chance at life.
Yeah, that seems significant.
Yeah, for sure.
So this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Schultz. If you just tuned in, my guest is Andrea Gibbon, founder of Protecting Paws for Life, a Florida organization dedicated to helping more domestic violence shelters become pet-friendly. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, when it's timely to note that only about 17% of domestic violence shelters nationwide currently accept pets. So if you'd like to ask Andrea a question about or offer a comment about this topic or rescue or some of the things we'll probably touch on, you can call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So you kind of mentioned in your very brief overview of kind of what you've all done in 27 plus years, but tell me more specifically about how dog training entered the picture.
Yeah. So when I was working in New Jersey with a rescue, there was a dog who was basically deemed unadoptable. He had held a family captive in their living room, but they were a no-kill.
How so?
They wound up on their dining room table, and he would not let them leave.
Super aggressive, you mean?
Super aggressive. And, you know, the owner of the rescue had to go in and bring him out. And because they were no-kill, he basically wound up at the boarding facility that they were using, and it was kind of hands-off. He kind of just let him be. And there were a couple of the boarding facility workers who could handle him. And I was kind of just determined. I just spent a lot of time with him, just sitting on the other side of his run, just talking to him. Got to a point where I could get him out of the run and actually got him to the point where he could be at adoption events. He wasn't being adopted out, but he would at least partner with me. We'd be able to be out in a park. He'd be able to meet people very slowly, but he would be able to meet them. And eventually, when I left New Jersey and moved to Texas, we built we got a wooden shed. We insulated, air conditioned it because we were in Houston, Texas, so it was hot all the time.
Really hot.
And built a 25-foot run for him. And so he got to live out the rest of his life with us.
So was the idea at that point, and even before that, when you were taking him to adoption events, but he wasn't being adopted, like, this is a dog that cannot be adopted,
correct,
just given whatever the issues are? And
yeah, there was too much liability around the potential aggression for him. But for me, it was, I didn't see it as a challenge. I saw it as breaking a barrier for him and being able to communicate with him. And so I think that's really where I fell in love with the dogs who need us the most and need the most understanding. And then from there, I just found myself gravitating towards those types of dogs, the ones that needed the most help. And so I always kind of just had this connection and was able to work with them. And then several years ago, I decided I think it's time for me to actually get my certifications and understand more of the science, do the homework,
sure,
so you can understand all of that. And it's just been...
It is a real science when you get down to it.
It really is. Yeah. And really understanding how their brain works, how their body reacts to things, because they can't tell us verbally, but they do communicate through their body, and just understanding that and what's going on with them. So I kind of just fell in love with it. And now I do run my own dog training business on the side as well.
Is that with the Heart Canine Care?
It is, yep.
And so you kind of specialize, I guess not surprisingly, if I'm not mistaken, in dogs that have challenges or present challenges, I guess, whatever is the best way to put that, right? Is that kind of the specialty of your...
Yeah, I do mostly rescue and shelter work with those dogs that have been adopted from those environments. I do partner with several local rescues as well to work with the animals that they have on property.
So a dog, let's say, has been adopted from XYZ shelter,
mm-hmm,
but is known to be kind of challenging or troubled in some ways. As part of that adoption, they get to work with you to sort of make the dog's behavior less challenging or troublesome, or
in some cases, cases, you know, I have partnerships. Well, they'll recommend me. In other cases, people just find me based on word of mouth. I love puppies, and I'll do puppy 101, but I definitely gravitate towards more the more challenging cases and the ones that really do come through rescue.
Yeah.
Who need that level of understanding.
And is it mostly aggressive dogs that you're seeing in those settings, or other situations?
No, aggression
as well
is definitely part of it.
Yeah.
But you'll also see separation anxiety. You'll see dogs that are just completely shut down from trauma. And so dogs that don't necessarily need your basic 101 type of obedience training per se, it's more about being able to manage their environment while you're working through the challenges that they're having.
And in some of those cases, are you working with the dogs before they're even put up for adoption?
Yes.
Because I would think that would be pivotal for some of those dogs who otherwise probably wouldn't necessarily be strong candidates for being adopted if they exhibit kind of behavior you're talking
correct,
about.
Correct, correct.
Yeah.
Yes, I do work with several different organizations before adoption.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. And I probably should ask this early on, but so were you an animal nut as a kid? Were there animals around in the family?
I mean, we always had a dog in the house.
Yeah.
But I wasn't, you know, I wasn't the girl outside rescuing all the cats off the street.
Okay.
It was just something that was like, I just always needed to have a dog. And then as I got older and got more involved with rescue, it just really grabbed my heart.
Yeah.
It really, really does, which I know a lot of people in rescue understand that.
For sure. Yeah. No, that makes sense, but it's always interesting to find out if people are the one that's tending to the sick or injured, you know, thing in the neighborhood, or if they've come to it later for one reason or another. It sounds like you're in the second category.
Yeah, but I pretty much, it's not that I would have ignored an animal that was in distress.
No, but
I
just sometimes those kids growing up, they can't get away from, they have some kind of extra sense about an animal that needs help or care, and they swoop in and they do it. But to me, it's great to, whenever you come to that, if you can help animals and do rescue and stuff, and especially the training thing now to help dogs. Are there animals? Are there cats or other animals you work with, or is it strictly dogs?
So me personally, I work with dogs. Protecting Paws does cover dogs and cats. So we have some cat behavior specialists that we work with that will help out with the cats. And I know enough to speak to cat behavior, but I'm definitely nowhere near expert level. And I do call in people that specialize in cats for that.
Cool. All right, well, let's kind of get to the focus of our chat, which is Protecting Paws for Life. So let's kind of set or reset the scene. As I mentioned in the opening, apparently fewer than 20% of domestic violence shelters nationwide accept pets. And again, that presents a serious obstacle, obviously, for survivors who often won't go to such a shelter without their pets and feel just as strongly about not leaving the animals at the home where the abuse takes place. So I think you might know from our correspondence, several years ago, it was about 7 or 8 years ago, I reported and co-wrote a piece for the Washington Post about this kind of topic, domestic shelters, and what was then kind of a trend to accept more pets was even fewer then. But I would have thought in the ensuing years there would be much more, I don't know if progress is the right word, but a larger percentage, let's say, of shelters accepting pets based on what I found when I was doing that reporting 7-8 years ago. So what are the obstacles that shelters seem to experience when they say, we'd love to offer that opportunity, but we just can't accept pets, and we don't see making that change?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it really comes down to resources. The funding to actually have a kennel on property, to train the teams properly, to have the supplies that they need. Some of the shelters have very limited space for the humans that they shelter. So adding animals is just a whole new factor. And I know the shelters that we work with, some of them, they just don't know what they don't know when it comes to animals because they're so human-facing, as they should be. It's definitely, domestic violence is a human-facing challenge. However, those, we call the pets the silent victims of domestic violence. And so considering them in their shelter environment becomes really important. As you mentioned, it becomes a huge barrier for people leaving.
Yeah.
They don't want to leave their pets behind because those are their kids too. So being able to kind of bridge this gap has been really important.
All right, we'll come back to that more, but it looks like we have a call, so we'll get that.
Sure.
Oh, actually, they held for a moment or two, but then they,
aww,
okay. Feel free to call back. It might take a second to go to get you on the, hi, you're on Talking Animals with Andrew Gibbon. Okay.
Oh.
All right, we'll keep trying. But if you do call in, just hang tight. You might be on hold for a moment or two, but we'll obviously get to all the calls that we can. 813-239-9663 for that. You can also email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So, yeah, you would think that maybe shelters can only just do what they can do, and maybe that's what this comes down to. But you would think with kind of the wide knowledge of survivors not feeling comfortable going to a shelter if they can't bring their pets, mm-hmm, that shelters would just do whatever they could, even if they could only accommodate a very small number. But it just seems like 17%, I can't remember what the percentage was when I was reporting that piece for the Post several years ago. I mean, it was obviously fewer than that.
Yeah.
But the progress seems very, very slow.
It is. It definitely is.
And what can be done to accelerate that in some way? Anything?
I think it's educating the public about the need for this so that there is more support, not just to organizations like ours, but
yeah,
to the domestic violence shelters themselves. Because basically, it does. It always comes down to funding for the shelters. Sometimes it's their insurance and the liability about whether or not they can have animals on property.
Yeah.
So looking at those types of things. But it does. It's so important to reduce that barrier. Right here in Florida, we have approximately 73 active domestic violence shelters, and 18 are currently taking pets. So our goal here in Florida is to raise that number and then help contribute to that nationwide number.
Wow. I mean, it's discouraging, especially when you know what's at stake. You just think, but I mean, I know you've already touched on some things. I remember just basically like who's going to clean the pet area, who's going to take care of food or veterinary care when that comes up.
Yeah.
What if other residents have allergies? You touched on the liability insurance, which I'm sure is critical. So I certainly see why shelters would be slow to embrace that, but boy, it just seems discouraging that the numbers are what they are, just given, again, this is so important, mm-hmm, for so many people who could, kind of change their life more readily if they had access to that shelter. And as we know, they're probably not going to want to come without their animals, right?
Yeah, agreed. Again, you touched on, allergies are a big thing, especially the shelters that don't have a separate kennel and the animals are living in the rooms. They have to be very conscious of who's next door, who's sharing the same air,
yeah,
if they're sharing a room, whether or not a dog or a cat can be in that room because the other person might be allergic. And then veterinary care is a really, really big one to take on expense-wise.
Yeah. I mean, if I were running a shelter, in some ways, if I didn't factor in kind of what was at stake, I would just say, well, this is too complicated and or too expensive. We just can't do it, or we can't do it this year. And then another year probably comes by, and nobody's trying to be insensitive and ignore an important issue, but they're probably just like, we can't.
Yeah.
In a lot of cases, I guess we don't have the resources. We can't solve that problem. We don't have staff to deal with who's got allergies and who doesn't, and what happens if somebody, mm-hmm, reacts that we don't expect, and so many scenarios.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's key that the leadership in the shelters understand the importance of this, which most of them, all of them do, but are able to put resources behind it, partner with organizations like ours to give them the resources and support that they need. Because what we do for them is at no cost to them.
So tell me more about what exactly Protecting Paws for Life does do.
Sure.
To walk me through the mechanics or just kind of steps that, when you approach a shelter or shelters collectively have you do it.
Yeah.
What happens and I know what the ideal outcome is, but what happens typically?
Yeah. So we have a really good group of people behind me that are all come from the rescue and shelter world. So all different facets of the world. So what we can do is we come in and we can train their team on basic animal care and handling, what to do on intake, how to scan for a microchip and how important it is to change that microchip information, because you never want an animal, God forbid, they get off property to go back to the situation that they came from. So just basic things like that. And in the animal rescue world that we, you know, take for granted that we know, you know, if you think about it in the domestic violence world, these are not things that they do on a regular basis. So it's just informing them of that. Things like how to build their kennel, how to make it fear-free. We have specialists in fear-free kennel design. So that's anything from the color of paint you use to the type of lighting you use, because natural light is incredibly important, to make sure cats have places to hide, that they can go up high, to make sure that there's music in the kennel rooms. So basically fear-free design in their kennel space, or if they don't have a kennel on property, how we can turn the rooms into fear-free spaces that they're sharing. And then we also work through disease prevention. So in the kennel spaces, how to properly clean, which cleaners to use, and all of that. And then from there, we also supply all of the pet supplies that they need. So we collect everything from food, litter, crates, carriers, everything you could possibly think of for animals. And on a monthly basis, we deliver them to all of our shelter partners. We're currently in 8 counties here in Florida. So we have 8 shelter partners, as well as we provide all the supplies to the pet pantry here in Pinellas County for CASA and their Family Justice Center. So each organization will place an order each month, and we pack up and we deliver. So we are very, very fortunate that we have about 15 different retail partners across the Tampa Bay area right now collecting supplies for us. So we're always in need because we're always replenishing. But that is a major part of what we do. And so being able to supply not just for the pets that they have on property, but we also supply any pets that may be in their system. So sometimes domestic violence survivors will call in and they need an advocate and they need legal advice or they need some type of support, but they're not necessarily coming to live at the shelter. But if they need pet support, the organization will contact us and say, hey, we have this person who's now in our system. They have a cap, they have no litter, they have no food, and we'll pack up and we'll deliver that. So we will support all of the pets that are within their system.
In a situation like that, Andrew, does that mean they're not coming to a specific domestic violence shelter, but it sounds like they're leaving their home and going somewhere in between, and yet they need help and litter and food and all the things to take care of the animals. Is that what's happening there?
Correct. So as long as they're coming through one of our partner organizations, we can support them. We also have a great partner here with Harmony Vet Care in the Tampa Bay area. And between the two of us, we've been able to provide vet care for over 20 animals over the past couple of months in this area, which has been great to no cost to the survivors, which is a huge thing, as we mentioned earlier. Veterinary care can be really expensive. And then the other thing that we do provide is we have several trainers on our team, including myself, and we provide one-on-one behavioral care for some of the animals that may have challenging behaviors. So if the survivor is willing to work with us, we can go and work with them and their animals.
Okay, it looks like we have another call. So let's see if we can get them involved in the conversation. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Andrew Gibbon.
Yeah, you know what, man? I'm sorry to bother you, but I need to reach the office about my credit card that I pay every month for you guys.
And okay, seriously, you're on the air on live on a broadcast. Please, I'm sure you can find the number. Thank you. Anyway, sorry about that. This is Talking Animals. My guest is Andrea Gibbon, founder of Protecting Paws for Life, a Florida nonprofit helping to make more domestic violence shelters pet-friendly or help in those regards in other ways. And it said that just 70% of shelters nationwide are pet-friendly currently. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, so We're obviously doing what we can to boost awareness, and you're welcome to call in about the topic at 813-239-9663. Email dj at wmnf.org or texting 813-433-0885. So it sounds like it's just Florida-oriented, the efforts of protecting PAWS.
Correct. As of now, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Is that a hint at a sort of more national ambition at some point?
We definitely want to support the state of Florida. So yeah. We're in 8 counties now. We are looking for some more funding in order to be able to grow even more to support throughout the state. We can support out of state virtually right now with some of our online resources, because we do provide an entire training packet that they can have access to. So that is a way that we can grow until we can, you know, support having boots on the ground in other.
With that in mind, are there any sort of numbers or specific kind of goals that you're sort of looking at? Like, we can at least dream about going to these other states or other shelters outside of Florida. I mean, are there any things that the people sort of, in a perfect world, there'd be X amount more shelters across the state?
Yeah, I mean, definitely we want to spread throughout the state of Florida first, make sure that we grow appropriately to support what we need.
Yeah.
You know, our big goal, our end goal, is to have a sanctuary property of our own where, one, we would work with the rescue communities for dogs and cats that were deemed unadoptable. They could come live with us forever. But the second part of that is continue protecting PAWS' mission and be a foster home for domestic violence survivors that are leaving their home. They have a safe place to go. They're not going to shelter, but they need a safe place for their animals so their animals could come live with us temporarily.
All right, I want to maybe delve back into that more too, but sure. Let's take another call that hopefully pertains to the topic. And hi, you're on Talking Animals with Andrea Gibbon. Oh, I guess we just lost them.
Oh, no.
What a weird day for the phones. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
But, no. So that's an important thing. So there are situations where you guys will say there's someone that's not in a position to go to a shelter, but they're not in a position to stay in the home.
Yes.
But the question is what to do with their animal or animals, yeah. Plural. So that's an option, is that you might help arrange for foster care for that animal in the interim while they kind of solve whatever the longer term picture might be.
Correct. So we actually have a brand new partner that we brought on board called Bestie B&B. And they are an emergency foster network. It's online, super confidential, and it was built specifically for that. So our domestic violence partners can sign up with Bestie B&B, and then there could be confidential placement for foster homes for those animals. So it's a really great service. Right now we're trying to build the foster network. So if there's anyone in Central Florida area that is interested in becoming a foster for domestic violence animals, bestiebnb.com would be the place to sign up for it.
And for people who have or at least know about fostering, are there some different elements to fostering in this situation that people, yes, should be aware of?
Yes, absolutely. This requires a full background check, complete background check. Bestie B&B wants to ensure that these animals are going to safe places and that confidentiality will be secure, because that's incredibly important. And then the foster and the survivor are connected via an online chat system, but they don't know who each other are. So it's a way for the owner and the foster to stay connected. They can send pictures and videos so the owners can still be involved in the care of their animals, but they will never know who they are or where the animals are, because that is just... And that's different, obviously, from fostering for a rescue.
Sure,
because there's,
yeah,
not an owner involved. You're usually fostering with a rescue.
Right.
So there is still an owner. So we want to make sure we're doing everything right by the owner. But those organizations that are supported by us, we ensure that those fosters still have all of the supplies that they need, just as in the rescue world. We make sure they have their food and their bedding and all,
yeah,
of that, and the vet care. And it's just a matter of us building that network out here so that we have access to more fosters.
And obviously, people are deeply protected under that system where they're never really quite aware who the other one is.
Correct,
but
yes.
But they're being helped by that secret foster is helping them tremendously at a difficult,
absolutely,
time in their life.
Makes a huge, huge difference. Yeah. And the organization itself is kind of the mediator in there. They go between, they can monitor the conversations to make sure that confidentiality is secured.
All right, let's try one more time. See if we have any better luck. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Andrea Gibbon.
Oh, hey, Duncan. Hey, this is David, Mr. White Pepper Bryant. How are you doing?
Hey, David.
I was just curious, in terms of the animals that are in these situations, are they often abused too? I mean, by the abuser?
Yes, yes. We do see abuse. More so, their use as coercion and control. The threat of abuse is what really we see the most, but you do see abuse of these animals. Unfortunately, I have a million stories, which I don't need to go into right now, but the simple answer is yes, you see them.
I mean, essentially, as I recall from all the research and reporting I did, they're really used often as pawns. Like, hey, if you leave, this is what's going to happen to Fluffy or Rover
exactly.
or whatever.
Yeah, a lot of times the abuser will purchase a puppy or a kitten for their victim and then use that throughout the entire course of their relationship as, wow. as a threat, as control, and for reasons for them to not leave. And this is why it's so important for us to have more safe places for them to go with those animals.
For
those
sure.
animals, because in a lot of cases, while the animal may not have been a victim of abuse during the situation, if the person does leave, that animal is of no use to those people. And that's where we see those animals abused, neglected, or even killed.
Wow. Thanks for your call, David. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for all the hard work that your guest is doing. I think that's amazing. So
thank you so much.
Thank you. Hi, you're on Talking Animals, Andrew Gibbon.
Hi there. So, love the show. Thank you to the guests for being on. Really appreciate all the work that you're doing.
Thank you.
One of the questions that I had that I think that maybe some of the listeners would like to know as well, in the event of a hurricane or a tropical storm, what facilities or what services you are out there for people in the community that are being displaced, that have to evacuate, that can't take their pets with them. Do you have any recommendations or any type of information or a plug for what, you know, pet owners could do in that type of event? Because, you know, as you know, this is where we're at.
Completely understand. It is not an area that we specialize in as far as that goes. I know that there are several shelters within the Tampa Bay area, human shelters, evacuation points that do accept animals. So my advice would be to make sure that you have that list prior to hurricane season ready for you if you do have to evacuate. Obviously, there are certain hotels that would take animals. I do always recommend that you make sure you have a hurricane pack for your animals, not just for yourselves, and make sure you have something that's ready to go for the animals. Make sure you have their food, an extra bed, bowls, their vet records. Make sure you have that. If you don't have it electronically, have an updated printed copy before hurricane season hits. Make sure
all that's good, like their vaccination records and all of that.
Yeah. Because a lot of these shelters will require that. So you want to make sure.
Yeah, you don't want to get stuck at the door when there's a storm coming.
No, not at all. Right. Not at all.
Right.
And then there's, you know, for our involvement, so last year, obviously, we know we got hit back to back, and we were just getting our boots on the ground. Honestly, we were just formed. We did a massive supply drive for the hurricanes last year of pet supplies. We had, I think it was 27 locations collecting supplies for us, and we actually personally delivered supplies to anybody affected that needed pet supplies that reached out to us or that we found out.
Like so that we could. Island or?
Yeah, we went out to the islands. We, you know, just people that, you know, they lost their cars, you know, their homes were damaged. I remember there's one woman that will always stay with me. I pulled up and I brought in, I think it was 2 bags of food and beds because she had lost everything. And, you know, she just had tears in her eyes. She's like, I was on my last piece of ham to split between these two dogs for dinner tonight.
Oh, wow.
And that
oh, my goodness. Wow.
Always,
talk about goosebumps.
Yeah, it just always stays with me. So, you know that in the aftermath that we're here to help as well. But my advice on hurricane season is be prepared. Know where you can go. Do your research and make sure you have that emergency pack for your pets.
Do you have a recommendation? Where could I easily find a compiled list of those types of places, or is that just something that I have to kind of do the legwork on?
No, I do believe, and I may be wrong on this, but I believe I've seen it because I'm in Pinellas County, and I know in Pinellas County we have an app that is emergency readiness app, something to that effect, so correct me if I'm wrong. And there's a list of shelters, and I remember seeing like there's asterisks next to shelters that are pet friendly.
Okay.
So I'm not sure which county you're in right now, but
I'm in Pinellas. Yeah, I'm in downtown St. Pete.
Okay, that should really help you then.
Yeah, I would look up for the Pinellas County the emergency readiness. I think it's emergency readiness app. I know I have it on my phone, but I don't have my phone on me right now to look it up. But,
It sounds like it's readily available, especially with you being in Pinellas. So thanks for your questions. Very good questions, and appreciate your call. Thank you.
All Appreciate you guys. Keep doing the good work.
Thank you.
So here's just to backtrack a little bit, and if this ends up being at all personal or something you don't want to answer, then please don't. But I'm just curious how Protecting Paws for Life began. What was your impetus for starting it?
Yeah, so obviously once I fell in love with rescue, it's always been my dream to start a sanctuary of some kind. I even spent time out in the Best Friends Animal Sanctuary out in Utah.
Wow.
And taking their How to Build
There's a model. There's a sweeping, majestic model. Yeah.
And they had a workshop. It's a hands-on workshop on how to start your own animal sanctuary. And that's lived with me for a really long time. And so when I parted ways with the rescue that I was working with here, I kind of just did some soul searching. Like, what's next? What do I want to do? What's going to really fill my heart? And I had an amazing colleague who kind of stood by my side, and we just started kind of doing some research on this sanctuary, where I also had this idea of, you know, the people who needed us, needed support for their pets, could live on the sanctuary too. And so we kind of went down this route and fell in the domestic violence world, and started researching across the country the domestic violence shelters that were taking pets. And we had made several contacts of executive directors and shelter workers and their legal teams. And they basically came back and said, don't do the model that you're thinking. Don't deal with the people. Let us do that because we're good at that. There's a lot of liability. There's a lot of safety concerns, especially if you're going to have part of this open to the public for rescue work. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to consider the safety. So what we did was we formed Protecting Paws in the version that it is now, based on the feedback from our domestic violence partners of what they need, what they want, and the services that they could really use. And we have regular conversations with all of our current partners now to make sure that we're fulfilling those needs. And we're just growing and changing those needs based on those conversations. So it kind of organically came from this need of me wanting to still help animals and still be in the rescue world. And it's just kind of fine-tuning the process. But that idea of my sanctuary is still there. I still want that.
Right.
We're just going to change it so that makes sure that everybody's
safe on
property.
Well, there's a real long story arc here, one way or another, right?
Yeah.
It's basic rescue all the way to this and everything in between, including training and stuff. So how many, as far as you're aware of, how many other organizations across the country are counterparts sort of in one way or another to Protecting Paws for Life?
I know the one that's most similar and the most widely known is the Purple Leash Project.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, you know, supported by Purina and Red Rover. Very, very important work that they're doing. We do, I think, and I don't know all of the services they offer. I think we do a little bit more boots on the ground, but I'm not sure. But I would say that for another organization that lines up with what we do, that would be the one that's most well known.
And back to sort of bigger plans, bigger hopes, whatever. Would it make sense to try to partner, if not with Purple Leash, then something else that's out there that's again, pursuing the same kind of agenda that Protecting Paws for Life is, in a way to give it kind of, in theory, more scope and more range and more flexibility to help people in different situations, especially because I'm sure sometimes people do relocate based on their situation.
Yeah, very true.
And so...
Very true. Yes, agreed. We have actually have made contact with Purple Leash and have some ongoing conversations right now. With
them. Good. That makes sense. So how is, kind of touching on this a little bit more directly, but we're in our final minutes here probably. How is Protecting Paws for Life funded?
Really by individual donors.
That's it?
We have a couple of very, very small grants that come our way to help with veterinary care. But right now we have about 15 different retail and veterinary locations that are collecting supplies for us on a regular basis, which is great. So if you see a box with our logo on it, drop off some pet supplies. But financially, it's, you know, going to events and meeting people and doing financial campaigns. And we've been very blessed with the donors that have come by. But obviously, you know, we could always use more funding.
For sure. So can you share, obviously any detail, but can you share like one or two stories of people that Protecting Paws for Life has helped in some sort of situation that they were in a tough spot with their animal and you were able to step in and help them in some way or another that you kind of look proudly to, like, well, that one, because of this nature or that detail or that person or whatever, I feel particularly good about that. I'm sure you feel good about all your successes, but are there one or two that stick out in some way?
Sure. So we have very limited contact with the survivors themselves for confidentiality purposes.
Yeah, even after you've helped them. And so same idea as when the foster situation is there's mm-hmm. still a distance that should remain between those, even if you're trying to help.
There is to some degree. So those that we have provided veterinary care for, most of those we have connected with one-on-one. And I would say that those conversations are just filled with gratitude because they're animals. They're so focused on what's going on with them and trying to get their you know, everything reorganized in their life. And, you know, they're in this, you know, transitional state and, you know, their animal starts coughing or has eye infection, ear infection. It's like, what do I do now? Being able to go and help them with their animals, take care of their veterinary care, that's definitely something that, you know, just warms your heart.
Yeah.
We've had several animals that we've transported ourselves to the vet, and some of our transporters are like, this, I get it. I get why this is so important, because when you drop that animal back off and you just hand them all the supplies and you hand them the ear cleaner and the prescription meds, and they're like, I don't have to pay for any of this, it's like it brings
suddenly
tears to your
things
eyes
are going so great for them, they can't even believe they're a good fortune, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's been really rewarding to have that connection. And then we recently did a feature with PBS, and they interviewed one of the survivors that we've worked with, and I've spoken with her several times, and just the way that our support has changed her life has been just incredible. And just to hear that and how grateful she is
that's great.
We've been able to provide her veterinary care, that we were able to get her all of her supplies. Her cats were allergic to the litter that we had given to the shelter, so we brought new litter. But even just being able to change out the litter for her was just a really, really big thing for her. And she was grateful. And for us, that's all it's about, is being able to help them in time that they need it the most.
That's great. Well, let's just mention for sure, the website is protectingpawsforlife.org, so you can find out more about what Andrea and I have talked about, but you can also, of course, send donations there. And also, in the midst of this drive to sort of collect, to whatever extent people can donate, food and litter and cat toys, dog toys, anything that would help an animal that may be setting up a new residence somewhere, whatever. So that can all be done at protectingpawsforlife.org. So, Andrea, thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals, and thank you and your colleagues there at Protecting Paws for Life for all your good work. I think it's hard to imagine something more important and valuable.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me here today.
For sure. In a moment, I'll speak with Jennifer Langston, who runs Golden Ears Sanctuary and Rescue, a specialized refuge for senior hospice and disabled dogs located in Wesley Chapel. Golden Ears has a major fundraiser, Barks, Bags, and Bruce, slated to happen on November 8th. We'll hear more about both in just a moment on Talking Animals on WMNF. Right now, we're going to step into the Comedy Corner with a classic piece here at Talking Animals from Paul F. Tompkins. It's called Alternative Pets, from Paul Tompkins, in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
People have their alternative pets on their person. People walking around with animals on their body. See a guy who's got an iguana hanging out up there on his shoulder? See another person with a crazy cockatiel just hanging out? And I guess you're supposed to have some reaction to these people, you know? I guess what they want you to say is something like, well, pardon me, sir. Is that a bird on your shoulder? Well, you must be one fascinating individual. Your personality is not at all manufactured. I say, what if we were to exchange addresses and became pen pals? That way I could collect your letters in a bound volume entitled My Correspondence with the Most Interesting Person Alive. Working hard for you. That's great. You can have any animal that you want, you know, because we have dominion over the beasts of the fields and all, you know, but here's the thing. Even animals need some alone time, okay? How about that, you know? Maybe the lizard would like to sit at home, play on the rock for a while, you know? Maybe the bird would like to play with the bell, look in the mirror for a little bit. Maybe they don't have to come with you on all your jackass errands. How about that? Leave them alone for a minute. Come on, Cecil, we're going down to the bank so everybody can see your crazy eyes. Woo!
Come on. That was Paul F. Tompkins in today's Comedy Corner. The piece called Alternative Pets, taken from his album Impersonal. Now it's time to talk with Jennifer Langston about the distinctive sanctuary she founded, Golden Ears Sanctuary and Rescue, and their fundraising event, Barks, Bags, and Brews, coming up on November 8th. Let's hear more about both by welcoming Jennifer Langston back to Talking Animals on WNF. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning, Duncan. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals.
Thank you for having us.
So first, I'd like to ask you to maybe just kind of describe Golden Ears. What is it? When did you start it? And just, you know, give me kind of a good elevator type pitch, if you could.
Absolutely. Golden Ears was founded in 2019, and it is a senior hospice disabled dog sanctuary located just here in my house in Wesley Chapel, Florida. I work from home, so I'm able to keep a close eye on all of our babies and, you know, provide them the best end-of-life care and comfort with complete dignity.
And is it necessarily now? I mean, I know initially when we spoke, part of the dogs often were sort of in hospice, but I guess it's kind of, at least to my mind, maybe widened out a little bit for their disabled, but not necessarily end-of-life situations, but maybe I have that wrong.
Yeah, no. Well, the situations with the disabled ones, for instance, we have Olive and we also have Grayson. Both are unable to use their rear legs, and a lot of times that is a degenerative disease. So eventually they will become hospice because that disease will take over their neurological system. So we're able to keep them as comfortable, keep them as active as possible, which is what allows them to live a better, more quality of life.
I got you. All right. So how do you hear about all sort of prospective Golden Ears residents? I mean, you must be contacted constantly, I'm guessing.
I've got a couple of emails and phone calls to reply to today, and we're actually interviewing a potential intake, a very senior dog out of a local county shelter that was part of a cruelty case. So we're getting some information about her right now and going to be making a decision if we're going to bring her into the sanctuary as well. But yeah, it is a constant influx of requests, asks for help and things like that. And, you know, our goal is if we can keep a senior dog in their home, we will do what we can. We have provided food and supplies and things like that, so that if the owner, if it's really just a financial situation, we're happy to abide and get them what they need so that that animal stays where it's most comfortable with its owner.
Boy, yeah, that's you probably want to say yes to almost all the requests, but you probably just can't. So what's the criteria where you're contacted like you have been just even today? And you
Our priority is actually the animals that are in the shelters. They're the ones that we see as needing the most. For example, we have Reba, who is with us, that came out of our local shelter, found as a stray, with an aggressive oral cancer. And so we immediately said yes and brought her in, took her to our vet. We did get a procedure. It's a debulking procedure, so they did work on her mouth to bring her some comfort. And so, you know, we find that those are the animals most in need. I wish we could say yes to every single dog, but there has to be a limit to what one, you know, sanctuary/rescue can do. So we try to focus on the ones most in need at our shelters.
And it sounds like you're doing a sort of triage then to make those decisions.
Yes.
And are veterinarians at least discounting, if not donating, their care? It seems like so much of what your work involves, there's vet appointments, vet care, vet, you know, rushing over to see the vet suddenly. How does that work?
We put a lot of miles on my truck.
Yeah.
To and from the vet. But yes, we have a wonderful relationship with a local vet here, and as well as an emergency vet that's in the area as well. And it is a privilege to work with them and to have that open dialogue so that we get the care, our dogs get the care that they need immediately. And we are extremely grateful for that working relationship.
All right, but still, I know there's a lot of costs, a lot of food, a lot of other things.
Yes.
So let's talk about how you fund all this. How is it funded?
Well, it is by private donations, and events such as the one coming up November 8th, Barks Bags and Brews. It's our 7th annual cornhole tournament at Tiki Cove, located in Land O'Lakes. And it is a wonderful laid-back event. We invite anybody to come out. Even if you don't like cornhole and don't want to play the sport, you're more than welcome to join us and have some great, you know, food and some drinks and just hang out while we watch the chaos ensue.
That's great. So, again, that's November 8th. I think it says something I saw, 3 p.m. check-in. So if people are hearing about this, want to find out more or want to sign up or register, is there a way to do it in advance, or how does that work?
Absolutely. We encourage registering ahead of the event. That the link can be found on our website at goldenearssanctuary.org, as well as on our Facebook page, Golden Ears Sanctuary. There is an event specifically for this event that has a link to purchase your registration.
And is in the link, in the URL, is it ears plural or ears singular?
It is plural. Golden Ears.
Okay. I thought I saw something. I probably was wrong. I probably looked too fast. I thought I saw something that just had ears singular.
Okay. But, of course.
No, that's great. So how many people, based on this being the 7th annual, in the past, how many people have turned up at the tournament?
Well, it's a range. We've had as much as many as 40 up to almost 70-75 people.
Wow.
It's not a ginormous event. But
well, that's a lot of cornholers, if you ask me.
Well, some people just want to hang around.
They're, sure.
And join their loved ones who are playing. And so we all just literally have a great time watching everybody play. My brother is what we call, quote, the game master. And he and my sister-in-law oversee the event. I just stay in the background and sell the raffle tickets and get to, you know, kibitz with everybody that comes to see who we've brought from the sanctuary. This year, it may be Annie or it may be Grayson again. But it's just, I just love the fact that it's so laid back.
That's great.
It's a wonderful venue.
All right. So people can find out more or sign up at goldenearssanctuary.org.
Yes, sir.
Okay, well, that's great. Well, thanks for all your great work, Jennifer. Thanks again for joining us on Talking Animals, and good luck with Barks, Bags, and Brews. That's, again, on November 8th, so people have some time to make their plans.
Thank you, Duncan, for this opportunity. It's great speaking to you.
For sure. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Coming up, I'm WNF. It's The Conversation, the great show hosted by Mara Nunez and Joe Kane Carter. After that, it's The Scoop, WNF's brief news recap. Then we shift back into music programming with Craig Hugel sitting in today for Sam from 1 to 3, followed by Nancy C hosting the Traffic Jam from 3 to 6 p.m. Then Ali with San Safari, all kinds of great music and programming after that on 88.5 WNF Tampa. So I reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals. My guest next Wednesday, October 29th, will be Joshua Lisbon, a mountain lion researcher at the center of a new documentary premiering on the 29th on the PBS series Nature. It's called Willow Diary of the Mountain Lion, and it reflects a decades-long study in Montana revealing never-before-seen behaviors. The mountain lion is told to focusing on the story of an orphaned female mountain lion Willow and her cubs, drawing on footage by some 200 trail cameras. So it's pretty remarkable. We're talking about that with Joshua Lisbon next Wednesday here on Talking Animals. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next Wednesday with that show. The Conversation's up next here, and there's more great programming all day long and into the night on 88.5 WMF Tampa. Thanks so much for listening. Catch you next Wednesday here on Talking Animals. Thanks.